again, the Democratic Party has embraced some elusive middle, and they lose. Perhaps they really don't have an alternative to embracing left populist energy. Maybe that will work. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
What's going on?
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Call a code.
Get an ambulance back from the nurse's station.
Heart's still working, means synapses are still firing. You just need to get a message through.
It seems the vast majority of political analysts and pundits agree we're watching a train wreck in progress when it comes to democracy. If it continues on pace, democracy itself is in serious trouble in the upcoming elections. It's quite clear what the new far-right Republican Party is for: authoritarianism, religious nationalism replacing our republic. But yet again, as has happened a sickening number of times before, no one knows what the Democrats are for. Average people, notably in the Midwest, clearly see Democrats as obsessed with a non-candidate Donald Trump, who they largely adore. Aside from Build Back Better, which is really pretty good, how is it that they so thoroughly fail to connect with and inspire what should be and used to be the Democratic base of working people who live in less densely populated regions? Though the leadership of the Democratic National Committee chooses to keep its blinders on as they head straight on to another crushing defeat, there are alternatives right there in front of us, and history shows they work. If Democrats can only locate their backbone and not rush tail between legs to some imagined inoffensive middle, there is another way. It's right before our eyes. Our guest today, Professor Wallace Hedl, gets it. Will Democrats dare to take off those corporate-fitted blinders and consider another better way, one with much greater likelihood of success? As Democrats do nothing, the Republican Party is a well-oiled machine, fired up with great enthusiasm and drive. Dr. Hedl, I believe, will tell us what Democrats are missing. Dr. Hedl has recently written an article titled, "The Democrats Don't Have an Alternative to Embracing Left Populist Energy." Wallace Hedl is professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa, and he regularly teaches survey courses on U.S. history. In addition, he teaches on topics such as the Civil War and Reconstruction and the American radical tradition. He's taught seminars on such topics as Mark Twain, American slavery, and the Civil War in American culture. His most recent book is The Confederate Homefront, A History of Documents. While he enjoys studying the South, Dr. Hedl is a lifelong resident of the Midwest. His columns have appeared in The Chronicle of Higher Education, The History News Network, Raw Story, Newsweek, Al Jazeera, and Yahoo News. The article that got my attention is titled, "For 2022, the Democrats Don't Have an Alternative to Embracing Left Populist Energy." Dr. Hedl, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
Good to see you.
And as you say in your opening paragraph, little wonder the Democrats have an enthusiasm gap, end of quote. What does this enthusiasm gap look like? What are some manifestations illustrating that enthusiasm gap?
Well, have you been to a political rally lately? There aren't many.
That's true.
And that's what he started talking about the populace, was that these were people who, not just in election years, but all the time, had picnics and gatherings and speakers, and they created what one historian has called a movement culture. And a movement culture would be a culture of people who are together, expanding their ideas, teaching each other, learning from their experiences, not just 8 weeks before the election, but year-round.
Yeah, interesting. It's about a movement, and these Republicans seem to have learned from that, but not us. You know, we just wait, as you say, till right before the election, and guess what? That doesn't work. I noticed there's some organizations around that Democratic support groups have agreed that the strategy for winning in 2022 must be around educating people. Now, I've been around Democratic politics for many decades, and every year After loss, we gather to lick our wounds, and the same prescription is offered each and every time. We got to get out there and educate people. I think that plays right into the conventional wisdom that Democrats are elitist and reinforces the enthusiasm gap. What about this go out there and educate the people, do you think? How's that going to play?
Well, there's the old saying, which is, who will educate the educators? Where will we get our ideas that we're going to teach? And the answer is, honestly, I don't know. And as I reread the opinion piece that you so kindly called me on the show for, I realized that I was missing one thing, which was to have enough humility. I have some ideas for how political activity can work, but I think we have to start from the place that, well, go back to the best and brightest, right? The guys who started the Vietnam War.
Right.
They were conventionally the best and the brightest. They'd gone to the right schools. They didn't speak Vietnamese or even have any specialists who spoke Vietnamese, but they were the best and the brightest.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I, in my job as a professor, I get to listen to myself speak a lot. And I'm very persuasive to myself. I just want to start to say, I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. That said, can I take issue with something you opened with?
Sure.
Well, anyway. When you speak of the Republicans as a well-oiled machine, I think that's right, in a sense. They do better in elections than they do if you were to poll their individual positions. And that's a sign of political strength. I'm not convinced, though, that they're a well-oiled machine. I think, for one thing, they are still rallying around a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that you get the presidency and don't get a second term.
Yes.
Because the powers of incumbency are so great. Trump had the powers of incumbency. One thing he did, just to give one example, he started a trade war with China. And that, and therefore, China put down some tariffs that really hurt Iowa farmers. And Trump responded to that by dumping all kinds of money on Iowa farmers.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that if you're an incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
So why would a guy who has the policy, has the power to do that, why does he lose? I think that's a question we should be asking, just so that we're not too much on the defense. Does that make sense?
Yeah. He had all that power. I mean, Bush the First also lost after one term, but you're right, it is pretty rare. So
it is. And Bush the First, he was coming off, when he ran for re-election, he was coming off three terms of presidential Republican. Reagan had it for 2 years.
True.
And then H.W. Bush. So the Republicans kind of had their time.
Uh-huh.
So what Trump did really takes some doing. I worry about people who want to focus the next election on Trump.
Right. Well,
I mean, yes, the guy tried to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
That's a good reason. But I think you also have to focus on checkbook kind of issues.
Absolutely.
What you can do for ordinary people.
Yeah. And reaching the people in, for example, Iowa, where you are, you can't. I mean, it was Democrats in a way got lucky because Trump was so bad that Biden won. And I think, quite frankly, in 2016, the arrogance and elitism that was shown across the country by our nominee also elected Trump. In both cases, I don't think it was so much for the eventual winner, but against the other person. And I've long thought Democrats need to be for something. You know, if they hoist something up their flagpole and we don't, usually they win. But the Democratic National Party is not all the Democrats. And I think that's important to recognize. And as you point out, in 2016, the Democrats nearly nominated a Democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders. But of course, the moneyed influence of Wall Street on the party powerful forced their choice on the party. And we know what happened. There are two questions in there, not which or which to do first. What was the unique and unexpected strength of the Bernie movement? And what role did the perceived elitism play in our nominee losing what should have been an easy cakewalk?
Boy, there's a lot in that goodness question. Start with Bernie. I do get somewhat of a privileged point of view in Iowa because of the caucus system. I don't think the caucus system being focused on one state is a great idea, but that's the way it is. So Bernie was such a surprise. The first rally I went to with Bernie was on Father's Day. And I brought my son, who was maybe 14, at the time. And leave aside that I came out of the rally excited by ideas that were so different and by using this word socialism, which was a no-no in American politics.
Yeah.
I was excited by that. But then my son actually signed up to volunteer. And he didn't have 14 years of hearing how bad socialism was.
Yeah.
He was listening to things that made sense. Checkbook things mostly from his point of view. So Bernie was an exciting thing. Now you ask for Hillary Clinton, and I'll give you another Iowa story, which is that I was teaching an 11 o'clock class at a time when Hillary was going to give an event at 12 in our student union. So the distance between the history building and the student union is about 75 feet. So I finished my class, went down to see the Hillary rally, and she'd done it completely differently than any candidate I'd ever seen before, which is that she had space for about 75 people, and these were chairs set down, so the room could have held more people standing. But she had 75 chairs or so, and then three big TV cameras. And so people like me who came in a little on the late side were blocked. I had to move around and shove people to see her. Now, we know she's not a dynamic speaker, and that could be okay. Person, she was even less dynamic than I would have expected. But also, there was this barrier between me and having decent sight lines to see her, because her event was organized around TV.
Wow.
Rather than actually reaching people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a connection between her lack of national political talent. She's top to that, right? She said she's no Obama, no Bill Clinton. And that would be fine. Lots of politicians aren't natural. But the second part, planning your event in a way to exclude people from actually participating, is not good. I'm convinced that TV is going to be less and less important as time goes on, and so you got to think of other ways to reach people.
Interesting point. There is the competition to TV, the so-called social media, and I know from my own campaigns, the personal touch absolutely matters. On the ground, reaching out to people, connecting with them, and listening to people, opening up and listening to people. And, you know, we Democrats just haven't gotten that. There was the election just recently down in Virginia where the candidate was remarkably elitist, and he got squashed. You got to listen to people. And I, you know, we can see that the Trumpists, a lot of people said they felt like, well, Trump cared about me. He's okay with me as I am. He's not trying to change me. It just, you know, connects with who I am. And it's a different dynamic now. I think that's important, that TV is probably less important now. Who would have thunk it? For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And actually, we picked this name before 2016. Who knew? Our guest today is Professor Wallace Hettle, who is a professor of politics, or history, rather, at the University of Northern Iowa. And I was in Iowa in 1984 working on the George McGovern campaign. He came in a tight third there, and I was impressed with Iowa. I think we need to get back to the Iowas, the Midwest, the people that live there. And there used to be something, as you know, called prairie populism. And that was most strong in the Midwest. And that I believe, also came out of the another Gilded Age. And somehow we just kind of lost that and just abandoned the Midwestern culture. And what can you say about that, you know, the 1890s, Lawrence Goodwin, author Lawrence Goodwin, describes as a movement culture. The Trump people have had a movement culture. The Tea Party was a movement culture. We don't got that. Tell us about that, please, the movement culture back then.
Well, let me talk about movement culture now first.
Yes, great.
Right now, this is just a small example of how the process works. We know that in the typical election, the parties will identify maybe 8, maybe 10 battleground states, and then they'll dump all the advertising money they can get into TV ads and now Facebook ads. And it was worse than last time around because of the coronavirus. Democrats didn't feel like it was a good idea to campaign door to door, and I wouldn't want to question that.
No, for sure.
But this notion that we should identify the states we can win and then dump money on them, it does serve the interest of political consultants. I know Joe Trippi from the 2004 Howard Dean campaign.
Sure.
He made $5 million in the matter of 3 months for making terrible commercials. And he's not the last person to have done that.
Yeah.
Terry McAuliffe is another example. A big money approach that, of course, is going to turn people off. Most people don't have big money. They can't imagine what it's like to have big money. And if someone like Trump or Josh Hawley wants to do what somebody's starting to use the term reactionary populism, this is used by a historian, Nathan McLean, describing the Klan in the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
They were reactionaries in that they were against things like the labor movement, but they posed as men of the people, as the people like George Wallace, who's had this go through our history, and it worked.
Yes.
Can I go back around to Iowa, though? And
yeah.
What is Iowa? There's a question of how we deal with the Midwest.
That yes, absolutely.
Is one that's animating to you. And I have steam coming out of my ears about when I hear of Iowa being reclassified as a red state. And the reason why is because Iowa went for Obama twice. And there are two states where the majority of people, let's say the majority of white people, voted for Obama in 2012. Well, I guess that they are?
Well, Iowa, if, yeah, Iowa's one. There's not a lot of people of color there.
And Utah would be the other.
Oh, my. Ah, and interesting.
Next time we talk to a barista in Brooklyn, tell them that. The majority of whites in New York State did not support Obama in 2012. Anyway, Obama's success here, remember he won his first caucus here, came from the fact that ordinary Iowans are not a bunch of reactionary racist yahoos. And if you look at how our state government has gone Republican over the last 2 years, we just lost a governor's election, the last one, because the Democratic candidate, Fred Hubble, was one of the richest people in the state, and he was so entrenched in wealth that the governor's mansion is called Hubble House. So if Fred Hubble had won, he would have moved into his family's mansion, which has been appropriated for the governor's mansion in Iowa many years ago. This last Senate campaign, where Iowa elected Jody Urs, the Democrats had a decent opponent there. The first time Jody Urs, a senator, got elected, she was running against a congressman named Bruce Braley. And Braley was a very rich trial lawyer who made the mistake during the campaign of warning donors that unless something was done, Chuck Grassley, a farmer, would be running the Judiciary Committee. Now, you can imagine how well a full-throated denunciation of farmers would go over in Iowa. It didn't go over well.
Right.
And so I guess I'm saying, in the case of Hubble or Bruce Braley, is that these were bad picks. And it doesn't mean that Iowa can't come back to the place of being a purple state. There is a kind of Tom Harkin tradition in this thing that we should not give up on. And I think it will be debated in the next cycle about whether Iowa is a worthy place to put money.
But, I know when you communicate very clearly that we're going to fly over your state, it's not important to us, we're focusing on other states, what the heck are people going to do? That may have something to do with an enthusiasm gap. Go ahead.
I think that you have to rethink the way you do politics. It comes back to this example of having a movement culture.
Yes.
My son is a college student in Minnesota, and he's a very enthusiastic activist.
Excellent.
And every 2 years, he'll work for the Democratic Party, he'll knock on doors, and he was sad to see, after the last election, that his group, the College Democrats, didn't have anything to do. They spent 4 months knocking on doors, but there's no help for the Democratic Party. You could take a 25-year-old, pay them not very much money,
right,
and have them go from campus to campus organizing groups. Would it be hard to organize groups the last long time? Well, and the Democratic Socialists of America, I do it. They have an abundant network of campus groups. So I imagine the Democrats would do it too. The question becomes, why don't they do it?
Right, right.
And that would get you back to the problem in the party, that there's too many of the leadership are either in the 1% or overly sympathetic to the 1%.
Right. And that's, people remember, people do remember the Occupy Wall Street, and the phrase the 1% got stamped into the American consciousness, and it's still there. And as you say, your son and that generation, same as my daughter's generation, and I think a lot of I think there's so much potential for focusing on who's running this country. Whose country is this? Whose government is this? Is it working for you or is it working for the rich people? Now, the mainstream Democrats, the Hillary Clinton Democrats, can't possibly wade into that territory. They can't do that. But that's where the strength is, I think. But they're afraid to do it. They go for some center. And I don't think there really is that center. I think it's an imaginary thing that can keep their money coming in from the top 1% and not alienate people. But they lose. How is it that FDR connected with something that Huey Long was into? And he was a populist for sure. I don't know, left-right, sort of a combination of both. But Huey Long from Louisiana spoke about, you know, instead of waiting for crumbs to fall from the table, that we need a place at the table. And I just think that's more of a movement thing that we need. What your thoughts on what I'm talking about there?
Sure. The main way ordinary people are involved in the Democratic Party is knocking on doors, as far as actual activity. But the knocking on doors, to my knowledge, every mainstream candidate, including Bernie, who's run in Iowa, has had a script for the people who door knock to follow. And what the door knockers do is that they don't change votes, they harvest votes. You ask them who they support. You mark down the response on a 1 to 5 scale. And that response will then go back to the office and it will be used on election day because you've identified your supporters. And then you call them on election day and bring them out. There's been an academic, I don't want to say movement, but there's been some people in academia who have, I touched on something called deep canvassing. And this is not really a radical idea. When you canvass, you go to the door and you try to persuade people. Right now, Democrats only go to the doors of Democrats and if they have some extra time of independence. But talking to people, it shouldn't be that radical of an idea. The problem you can identify with having ordinary volunteers talking to people is that they could go off message.
True.
Right? But you can't have a popular movement without allowing people to talk. And sometimes people won't say the right thing. But Terry McAuliffe also might not know the right thing to tell them to say. Deep canvassing is one place where I would look. And the next thing beyond deep canvassing was having an ongoing organization that would have movies and speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And you could take a page from the Labour Party in Britain. They are not what they were 50 years ago. Times have changed.
Yeah.
But they do have bi-monthly meetings mm-hmm. in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a membership organization. And what you have to be willing to do is have your members meet, have them talk, and have them take ownership. Now, if you're Joe Trippi or Terry McCall, you might not like the results of that. But if you want to win, that would be one way to do it. Republicans, one thing they have is churches.
Uh-huh.
And that is a base for rallying the faithful and getting volunteers. The Democrats traditionally had, as the counter to churches, the union movement. And that is something that's not strong now.
Right.
But in part, that's because Democrats haven't fought for it.
Interesting, because there are a lot of church leaders, at least around these parts, that are, you know, pretty progressive. They, you know, believe what they preach. And I think there's some organizational possibilities there. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Professor Wallace Hettle, and he's written an article, "The Democrats Don't Have an Alternative to Embracing Left Populist Energy." And there's no question, isolation is really widespread today. The populists in the 1890s could understand isolation back then. They what did they do back then to address isolation and simultaneously build the movement that might prove applicable today?
Yeah, I think this basic idea, which shouldn't be that stunningly difficult, is just putting people together, and then when there are struggles, take the labor resurgence we've had this year.
Yes.
John Deere went on strike, 10,000 workers, and they won. They won quite convincingly. Do you remember any Democrats speaking up in support of John Deere? On the national level?
Good point.
I can't.
No.
Roosevelt spoke quite clearly about unions, and when Americans joined unions back then, they knew they were doing what the president wanted them to do. And we need something like that again.
Gosh, yes, it's so obvious. You're right. I mean, the union movement is roaring back strong. And Bernie Sanders has probably gone there to rallies. But, gosh, there's
right.
So much potential there. You know, with the airline workers and so many different teachers' unions. God, you know, there's a huge audience there. And yet the Democrats are afraid of it. And one thing
My state rep, the guy who goes to the legislature, is a retired John Deere worker.
Uh-huh.
So when we talk about Midwestern workers, we're not talking about people from different planets. You know, Bob Cressy is someone who stops by my door at least every 2 years. I'll usually see him around town at other times because he's very active in community organizations. And he's a smart, educated guy who happened to have worked on an assembly line for 30 years at a time when that was a viable middle-class thing to do.
Yeah.
And so I can't speak for New York, but in Iowa, we need to identify the Bob Cressys.
Right.
Some of that will be done just by picking up the phone and calling the union home.
And I do think, you know, average people, either whether they're with the union or not, most people do connect with that. We do connect with the idea of, you know, fair pay, fair compensation, fair, you know, timing, etc. The only people who don't are the owners of the factories. And just look at the numbers there. There's a lot more numbers on one side than there is on the other. And yet, I don't know how the Democrats hope to win with, you know, by maintaining that lack of courage in talking about things that actually connect with people. We know they'll connect with people. I wonder about...
Even if a tactic doesn't connect with people, let's say Amazon.
Yes.
There's a strong moral case made for unionizing Amazon.
Absolutely.
And you're right, liberal churches would be behind it. The thing is that Amazon's very good at stopping the hubs from organizing, although... We just had a successful warehouse for Amazon this week, and I'm forgetting where it's located. In any case, Amazon's been very good at their aware of unions and their possibilities. They've been very good about firing workers who are too active.
Mm-hmm.
But they can change it to Jeff Bezos. Bezos is, of course, owner of the Washington Post and an ardent Democrat. And so Democrats have to think about whether Jeff Bezos is helping the party. And clearly, Bezos would pay more taxes if he was asked to. We just need to ask him.
Yeah, I think I don't know, but you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people don't like Bezos, and they like Amazon, you know, as a basically like a public utility now, which is not really regulated. But I think there's a lot of potential support for unionization. It will happen eventually. They fight like hell, but it will happen. One thing I wonder.
I think that's a very good point. You made a very good point about Amazon as a public utility. My mother's ADA,
mm-hmm.
and she's living alone, and I don't think she could pull it off without Amazon.
Right.
And it's not like she has someplace else to go.
Right.
For that stuff. So thinking hard about regulating Amazon and actually applying our current labor laws to an Amazon, that alone would get you much closer to having individual warehouses win. Because that's another thing with workers and organizing. Workers tend to support unions when they have a chance of succeeding. If they don't, people don't want to see them. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, fear is a huge, huge motivator in politics, for sure. You know, like about 30 years ago, a Unitarian minister, a friend, told me there's only two things that motivate people in politics, fear and reassurance. And I think he's absolutely right. Today's far right Republican Party creates fear, blows it up constantly, pits one group against another. We don't trust other people. And as you're right, Republicans have effectively linked this basket of fears together under one umbrella. Defending the family against an intrusive government. Fears, of course, start wars. But are there good tools for progressives to address that have not thus far been picked up when it comes to this manipulation of fear? Yes?
Well, I think if I stick to my single-minded activism, concentration on getting people together, it's worth looking at the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is a group that was founded by Saul Alinsky, the famous community organizer, and then was kind of pushed along in the 60s by Bayard Rustin, who had been a trusted lieutenant of Martin Luther King. And the Industrial Areas Foundation now, they don't work elections. That's not their main goal. What they do is identify in communities and then set people their way to organize on those issues. So right now, last summer in Des Moines, the Industrial Areas Federation Foundation, this group talked to citizens and identified mental health as a key issue where a win could be made and where there was strong concern. Iowa has about 120 mental health beds in the state.
Oh.
So it's very dire. And so there's lots of people who got on board. But with the IAF, they as an organization don't worry too much about elections. They worry about getting ordinary people to do things like go talk to their legislator or their mayor or their city councilman and win them over to things that can be won. Getting another 100 mental health beds could be done. It's not that radical a thing. And gives people a sense of empowerment if they can, if you meet with the mayor of Ankeny, if you want an example, of a small town north of Des Moines. You meet with your small town mayor, maybe you don't get them on board right away. Maybe you do. But if you get together and talk about how to influence the mayor with an important issue where he can come around to our side, it's a phenomenal thing. And that's something that if the Democrats can help with that, they are not helping with that.
And I know, you know, respect, feeling respected, feeling listened to, that's going to move you. You know, if people don't feel respected, I mean, I know people of color who say, well, the Democrats come around to my church or barbershop, you know, once every 4 years, and that's it. You know, people aren't stupid. They get that. You have to keep in touch and respect them. You know, you can't just harvest, as you say, the votes. You got to be there. You have to touch base with it. One thing I've been meaning to ask is celebrity. It's amazing to me how much celebrity seems to matter. You know, in Spanish tradition, they had a caudillo, a guy who comes in riding tall on a white horse to save us all. Celebrities have become central. Issues, policy positions don't matter as much. Trump was a celebrity. Barack Obama had the celebrity thing going for him. Here in New Hampshire, we have a governor whose positions on virtually all the issues run counter to the majority opinion, but people don't pay attention to the issues. He's got a great smile. He seems nice. So he wins. How can we deal with that, with the whole celebrity thing and not just issues? That perplexes the heck out of me. You have any thoughts?
Well, the first thing that pops into my mind is that in my house growing up, I'm 59, so I can remember way back with the dinosaurs. And when I was growing up, we had a picture of John F. Kennedy.
Yes.
On the wall.
Yes.
And there have been people who tried to portray him as an empty suit or someone who was, we'll never know what he could have accomplished. But we do know that people like my parents believed he would have accomplished a lot.
Yeah.
And I think with Obama, his celebrity did come out of politics, and it was largely his talent combined with his race. And that kind of celebrity, I think, is okay.
Yeah.
He spoke a lot here. I mean, he pretty much took up residence in Iowa for a couple of months. And seeing how the guy was a speaker with talent that just was in a generation.
Yeah.
I think that's a different kind of celebrity than what Trump had. I think you're right, this celebrity is a real issue. I know a friend's daughter who once said, with not a trace of irony, the beautiful way a 12-year-old can talk, that she'd never seen a celebrity, except for politicians. And that's kind of the uniqueness of Iowa. But with Trump, I'm not the best person to ask about that because I don't have cable. And I'm maybe the only person who never has seen The Apprentice.
There's two of us.
I
can't either. But and it perplexed me back when I was running for re-election to the state senate here in New Hampshire. I was at some gathering and there was like a big lunch table, and this woman said, "Oh, I'm sitting with the celebrity." She meant me. I was a celebrity. But that, you know, it's just somehow connecting with people. And I think what you said about Obama basically camping out in Iowa, when you listen to people, people really, you know, they connect with you. And they want, people want to feel heard. There's no question about that. And, you know, you talk about defending family from, big government. People are afraid of that. Somehow they've wrapped it up with the anti-vax ridiculousness, but they don't want government interference. And yet, when it comes to reproductive rights, that's there. But something that, the culture war is working. It's really working for the other side. It's not about politics. It's about culture and using that fear and reassurance. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley is really on to something, I think, which touches on the fears about attacks on the family. He's got a full-throated, he's all about masculinity. He wants a revival of the dominance of a John Wayne version of masculinity. He knows Missouri, but how do you think this thing about masculinity is going to play in other Midwestern states? That obviously has a lot of political ramifications, but it's a cultural thing too. Your thoughts?
That's another one. I don't know. I do know that it's easier to declare yourself to be a real man than it is to have other people come to the same conclusion. And
true.
Trump was obviously successful with that, but there was a downside. He did terribly with women, and he might do worse with women if he runs again.
Yeah. But that masculinity, that masculinity, I think, really connects with a lot of people, and it's been there in so many different wars. And I noticed around here, a lot of the Trump people were like all about reassertion of white male dominance. And, they're scared about homosexuality, gay equality, abortion rights, things like that. And I don't know. That the cultural thing, I think most people are with us on that. But we're not exactly enthusiastically supporting something other than, masculinity. And there are other options. Go ahead.
Sure. We went from Obama to Trump. I was in 99 counties, 33 of them flipped from Obama to Trump. And you have to ask yourself why. And one reason was that the Democrats had a lousy candidate in Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
This is a person who nearly lost to a socialist, did lose to an African-American, and lost to Trump, who was not endorsed by major power brokers in his party. So this is someone who was weak.
That Trump, good point.
When Trump did the web. But also, there was a good study done out of Iowa State showing that the 33 counties that flipped were places that were more rural than even the five or six most urban counties in Iowa. And these places were places that were in free fall for all of the 8 Obama years. And these rural areas, not just here, but across the country, are being hollowed out. And you can look at that as some sort of inevitable economic process in which the most educated go to the coast because that's where the best jobs are. But I don't think that's inevitable.
Right.
What you could do for rural states is first improve the air service. Until 1978, airlines were required to serve cities. I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but in my town, we had 5 airlines, and now we have 1. We used to fly from my town in Northeast Iowa to Minneapolis, Kansas City, Chicago, and there was 1 other. Now it's just down to Chicago. And that's a good result of government regulation. Doctors are underpaid here in the heartland.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare payments are higher for people who live higher
income areas.
Cost of living areas. Why the government should be tilting the playing field in that direction, I have no idea.
And it could tilt it the other way. And if we ever get Build Back Better to actually happen and be an effect on the ground, I would think that could play well, you know, and create a lot of new jobs in the areas that, as you say, are hollowed out. There's all kinds of possibilities. And one thing I wonder about, people say, well, you know, West Virginia, Joe Manchin, he can't be seen as left. It's West Virginia, coal country. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Squad has great appeal on the two coasts. But is it realistic in the heartland? How is she perceived there? Would not tacking to that populist left spell certain doom for Democrats nationally? Your thoughts on that?
You know, I can't tell you what would happen in 435 different seats.
Right.
What I can say is that Ilhan Omar is from Minneapolis. The DSA a member who's a congresswoman outside of Detroit, she is from Detroit, or Gilmer, Illinois, a Midwestern place. So, I think we have to be more precise when we talk about Midwesterners. There's all kinds of Democratic sources on the Chicago City Council. And those are Midwesterners, too. So I think that taking, you know, a fourth of the country or a third of the country and trying to paint it with one brush doesn't really work. And what you do have to do is pay attention to them between elections.
Yes.
All policies that they care about. I'll give you another example.
Sure.
This is from the South. Mississippi, it's been decided, is a red state.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore not worth advertising in. But the population of Mississippi is 38% African American.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not looking at a state where it's impossible to imagine the idea of a Democrat winning.
There
are three full-timers. They have three employees right now, the Mississippi Democratic Party. One of them is one of my former students, and so that's why I know that. Three people for an entire state who have an ongoing presence. It's not enough.
And that goes back to where the Democratic Party was before 1964. It was the party of segregationists. No question about that. Lyndon Johnson took a big risk, but he won. He allied with the civil rights movement, and it worked. That kind of boldness, that's thinking, I hate to use the phrase outside the box because it's overused, but that's the kind of thing I think we're talking about here. People want some boldness. They don't want somebody with no backbone. They want somebody to stand up for them, and it can work. Democrats just, I don't know. They can't win by being Republican light, I don't think. I'm curious, you said that that Trump is the glue holding that party together. As we enter the election year 2022, what is your sense of the quality of that glue as we move forward?
Yeah, and there's in the piece, it's not super glue, it's more like Elmer's glue.
Uh-huh.
The kind that your kid might bring home from school, that's sort of on construction paper and it's falling apart.
Good.
that could be the case in Trump. We don't know where his legal situation is going to go on several fronts. And we don't know. We know that his party is gutless enough to stay with him.
Yeah.
What's astonishing, and I do think that people have to explain it better than they've done, is to see the text that was sent to Mark Meadows by people like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity. These awful partisans saw that something was going terribly wrong. And will the Republicans pay a price for that? They already have. They lost Georgia. They lost two Senate divisions in Georgia after January 6th.
Yep.
And we'll be having a completely different conversation about Biden right now, if not for those two seats.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I got to ask one last question, Professor Hedl. Democracy itself is under serious threat. I think really the greatest threat since World War II. Voter suppression is real. The threat of authoritarianism is real. Do you think, do people in the Midwest, in Iowa, do they get that? Is that going to motivate people? How does that play?
I don't know. I don't
direct.
Think it comes up very often.
Well, that's the thing.
With historians, always be worried about those who will predict the future. Because if I could predict the future, I wouldn't be teaching 9 hours a week at a small college. I'd be in Las Vegas playing cards.
But it's true. I don't think people connect that. It doesn't connect with their lives right now, which scares the crap out of me, I will say. It does. I don't know if Democrats, if they talk about, hey, they're threatening our democracy, is that going to cut it?
No. You clearly have to offer people something.
Yes.
And we know that from the cases of authoritarianism in South America or Europe.
Yeah.
You have to offer something, while at the same time, I think you can do both. Talk about the threat to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the question becomes, if democracy is threatened, it's threatened by who? Donald Trump, who's working for the 1%. So you can tie the issue of
economics
to democracy, I think, very, very dryly. That's what I see. As far as predicting the future, I would just emphasize Trump's age, his general ineptitude. He's pretty much done as president. His drawing power, it's hard to predict.
It's impossible to predict, and I'm almost always wrong in my predictions, but we try anyway. Fascinating discussion. Our guest on Keeping Democracy Alive has been Dr. Wallace Hedl, talking about how Democrats really don't have an alternative to embrace left populist energy. Well, we've been trying one thing, steering to some imaginary middle, and it's not working real well. I'm thinking maybe it's time to try something new. Thank you so much for being with us on the show, Professor Hedl.
Thank you, Bert.
Holiday greetings from Charles Dickens. My classic work, A Christmas Carol, will be performed on WERU not once, but twice on Christmas morning, December 25th. That's right, two marvelous renditions for the price of one. First, at 10 a.m., the Acadia Community Theater will present Down East Christmas Carol with all of your favorite characters transformed into Mainers. And then at 11, will feature the Trenton Elementary School third grade putting their wonderful acting skills to work in A Christmas Carol. It's Dickinsonian Community Radio at its best, Christmas morning, right here on WERU. I hope you can tune in.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Pinocchio.